start things out, I'll hand over now to Dr. Chris Wilkins.
Thanks for that, and thanks for inviting me along to present here. What I wanted to do today is just give you an overview of what's been happening with methamphetamine here in New Zealand over the last probably 8 years since the late 1990s. And we're just loading up now. So what I'll present today is some different pieces of research that have looked at methamphetamine, including the National Household Drug Survey, which surveys the general population about levels of methamphetamine use in the general population, and also data from our illicit drug monitoring system, which interviews frequent drug users, and we interview them about trends in drug use and their perceptions of what's going on in terms of levels of use and prices and potencies and things like that. The first slide that's going to come up is the National Household Drug Survey, which is a telephone-based survey, and it interviews the entire country and asks respondents about their levels of drug use. What you see here is we've been interviewing since 1998, and we've conducted a survey approximately 2 years up until 2006. And you see here that the largest increases in methamphetamine use occurred between 1998 and 2001, and that was the real expansion period of amphetamine use, where it was a new drug, a lot of people wanted to try it. So that was the real high water mark, was probably 2001. So the top line there is just showing levels of lifetime use in for amphetamine, methamphetamine, and the bottom line is use in the last 12 months. So you see 2001 was the high watermark, you could say, of the popular trend with methamphetamine. What's happened since there is there's been some leveling out, and now we're getting to more of a mature stage of the meth problem, where we've got an entrenched group of fairly frequent users. But we're aware that all, particularly survey methodologies, they all have their strengths and weaknesses. So what we also do in conjunction with that type of monitoring surveying is we also look at a series of secondary data sources, so other sources, and things like arrests and lab seizures, calls to the Alcohol and Drug Helpline, and also new entries into drug treatment to see if those types of measures are also consistent with what the survey has been showing us. So just seeing here, so as I said, so the population survey is basically showing us that we've probably reached our high point in 2001, but now we're tracking along at about 4 or 5% of the population using in the last year. And also, if we look at these secondary data sources, they seem to be consistent with that story, that there's been a somewhat decline or a levelling out of use. So the number of meth users, number of meth labs detected has declined from 190 labs in 2007 to 133 labs in 2008. Also consistent with that is that the calls to alcohol and the drug and alcohol helpline have fallen. These are related to meth problems, has fallen from about 1,900 in 2005-06 to 1,200 in 2007-08. And also positive screens for amphetamine amongst new entrants to Auckland-based drug treatment has also fallen away a little bit there. So if we go on to the next slide, one thing, so that's level of use within the general population, but we always have to keep in mind that at the population level, there's always going to be variations in amphetamine, methamphetamine use amongst different parts of the country. So geographically, this slide shows the geographical distribution of last year meth users, and you see consistent probably with what you sense in the general media is there's higher levels of amphetamine, methamphetamine use in the northern part of the country. So that's anywhere north of the Waikato, so particularly Auckland and Northland, and there's slightly less use within kind of the South Island. But these are findings from 2003, but more recent survey we've found that that's actually changed a little bit in that Christchurch is probably experiencing a little bit of an increase in methamphetamine as well. We see here, we've also, what we do with that data is we've been able to calculate relative sizes of the market here. So we've calculated the size of the meth market, the ecstasy market, and the cannabis market. Because there's some limitations with the household data in terms of being able to do this, because there's a level of underreporting in the household survey. It tends to be a good measure of occasional use, but not so much frequent use. So the best way to look at this, and what we were trying to illustrate with this, is that so the numbers we've got there are probably underestimations, and there might be a fair bit of underestimation involved in those. But the important point to get from this is that previous to the year 2000, New Zealand predominantly had cannabis market only, and that was worth something like $170 million a year. But subsequent with the rise in methamphetamine and ecstasy, you see if you combined the two sizes of the meth and the ecstasy market, it approximates the size of the cannabis market. So the end result is probably since 2000 we've doubled the size of our illegal drug market here in New Zealand with the addition of methamphetamine and also ecstasy. So if we quickly go to the next. Right. What we're able to do is using the illicit drug monitoring system, which interviews frequent drug users in the three main centres, we're able to just have a get a sense of the demographic profile of a frequent methamphetamine user. And it's going to come up. See, so what we find is three quarters of them tend to be males, median age of 27 years old, but there's quite a long range in years, and I think that reflects the fact that there is new young users of methamphetamine, but because methamphetamine is only just fairly recently arrived in New Zealand, a lot of older users were first-time users and started using at quite older ages. Also, you might want to note that there's a high level of unemployment sickness benefit within that group, and also a fairly high percentage of them have no school qualifications or only high school qualifications. So the real problematic frequent users tend to come from economically or socially deprived backgrounds, and that has impact on the problems they face and their ability to get out to get out of those problems. So a little further to the next slide, just a quick look at kind of patterns of use of frequent methamphetamine users. We see that the average amount of use was 2 to 3 times per week in that sample of frequent users, but about a quarter of those people were using daily. The median age of first use of meth was 21 years old, and that kind of reflects the situation that that, as I said, that methamphetamine has only relatively emerged in New Zealand since the year 2000. But an important thing to note here is that if you look at, I also included the age of first use of all the other drugs, so I think it's important to keep in mind that the first drugs that people use still tend to be alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis. And for this sample of frequent methamphetamine users, they're no different from that situation, but they tend to use drugs like alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis at a much younger age. So the ages there are the median age that they started using other drugs. So the median age was 13 years old for alcohol, and it can be much earlier than that, of course, and cannabis 15 years old, and then LSD and ecstasy, and then finally methamphetamine. So an important point to remember is it tends to be the case that in a drug-using career that meth is the drug they use last, and it tends to be used in kind of late teens, early 20s. And I think that has implications for any education or information you're going to give to high school students. I mean, the drugs that they're most likely to be using are still alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis.
Chris, we'll have to wrap up in about a minute, so we'll have to move through the next slides fairly quickly.
Yep. Yep. And then quickly, also, we asked them about the history of criminal offending. I think the reality here is, as I said, that meth use is now within different subgroups of the population. So for already criminally active people who have few legal means to pay for drug use, the obvious alternative for them in terms of paying for quite an expensive methamphetamine habit is to turn to crime, things like property crime and drug dealing. So it seems the situation, rather than that if they're already criminally active and they start using frequent methamphetamine, the expense is covered by escalating their level of property crime and drug dealing. So you see from this slide that of our frequent methamphetamine users we talk to, about two-thirds had committed property crime and drug dealing, and also violent crime was there as a factor as well. So if we go to the next, and also we see here, so this is contact with the police. And I think one of the important things to take out of this slide in terms of history of contact with police and courts is of the frequent problematic methamphetamine users that are involved in things like property crime and drug dealing as a way to pay for their drug use, they have really high contact with the criminal justice system. So they're arrested, something like 70% had been arrested, quite a large proportion had been in prison, quite a large proportion had been convicted of a crime, and about between 40 and 50% had been arrested in the last 12 months. So it is the case that these people are having contact with the criminal justice system, and to me that's a really good opportunity to do something with those people to short-circuit the kind of relationship between drug use and property offending, or drug use and social disorder. So there are opportunities to short-circuit that relationship. So what I've been arguing is that there is opportunities to intervene in the criminal justice system to get those people into treatment, get those people into counselling, and as part of their sentence in the criminal justice system. So what I'm saying is that through the criminal justice system is an excellent opportunity to divert people into treatment and try and solve the what's often the actual driving motivation for their offending behaviour, which is their drug use. And that can happen in many different situations, at arrest, at conviction, and in prison. And I think we really need to do better in terms of offering those solutions to offenders with serious drug problems. It's really hard to actually measure levels of drug tremble, but basically about 20% of our meth users had sought help for drug use but were not able to get it. If we just whip across to the barriers experience, next slide.
Mm-hmm.
We see here that there is a number of barriers that the frequent methamphetamine see is stopping them reaching treatment. So fear of what might be happening, fear of the police, but long waiting lists, didn't know where to go. So these are issues related to capacity for drug treatment available for frequent methamphetamine users. So it's a matter of having capacity, places to put people, but also having institutional means where they can be diverted to those opportunities.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. Any questions, please hold them till the end of the briefing. I will hand over now to Keith Bedford.
Good morning, everyone. And I have a series of slides, so I'll move quite quickly through these. The first slide shows the rise in the number of methamphetamine labs. The first methamphetamine lab we encountered back in 1996, and at that stage, street methamphetamine was generally less than 5%. It was heavily diluted and adulterated. Since that time, the name P is derived from the purity of the product from the local P labs, and some would argue that it represents a different kind of drug in terms of its impacts and effects because of the purity, and I'll come back to that point shortly. This graph shows the number of methamphetamine laboratories that ESR has encountered. The numbers vary a little bit between Chris's numbers and police numbers and ours. These are the numbers that our clandestine laboratory investigating chemists have handled. They have not all been active labs. Some of these are packed up, ready for use. And the trend downwards that Chris has referred to is a little bit unclear. There's no consensus on the reasons for this. There's certainly no evidence in terms of price and availability from the police perspective to indicate that the problem is going away. So there are other options, other possible explanations, which may include direct importation and so on. The next slide shows a series of what are called point bags. Point because they are purported to contain approximately 0.1 of a gram. 0.1 of a gram is 100 milligrams, and these are the street-level bags that are distributed. The next graph shows a summary of the purity of methamphetamine as a pie chart. Now, I need to explain something. Methamphetamine base is an oil, and the form in which methamphetamine is sold and used is methamphetamine hydrochloride. Because we report our purity as, in terms of the equivalent methamphetamine base, pure methamphetamine hydrochloride is 80% pure. So in this graph, this indicates essentially that the overwhelming majority of methamphetamine that's available to the illicit market in New Zealand is very nearly pure. I occasionally read scare stories where people are referring to ice or crystal meth and some of the dreadful stories that come from some other countries. There is essentially insignificant difference in purity between crystal meth or ice, which is simply large crystals of methamphetamine hydrochloride, and the main product that is being distributed in the New Zealand illicit drug market. I'm going to move now to a series of slides of clandestine laboratories. These are quite big images, and so they'll come up a little slowly, and I'll move through them quite quickly. A distinguishing feature of the New Zealand clandestine laboratory scene is the improvisation and the ingenuity that's used. Now, along with this, many of them are concealed, and so these are dangerous to deal with, and the fumes and the waste are not necessarily handled appropriately. So that's a series of slides. This one here shows what can happen when something goes badly wrong. This is actually a Canadian scene. There have been a number of explosions and fires in New Zealand, but I don't have a slide that's quite as spectacular as this one. And these are dangerous chemicals, and at times things can go very badly wrong. These are staff handling a clandestine laboratory scene. One of the features of the response from the agencies involved is a very close and necessary collaboration between police, which police may include the Armed Offenders Unit because of the involvement of gangs in these lab scenes, ESR, clandestine laboratory investigating chemists, and fire service. The fire service provides a lot of the positive pressure breathing apparatus that's required by first offenders because of the chemical fumes and hazards associated. And then behind those first responders, you have the support that's required from environmental protection people, from public health, and sometimes from the medical response for treatment of those exposed at the scene. It's very much a joint agency approach. The next couple of slides show what are called PAR bombs. PAR bomb is a very good description of what could potentially go wrong. This is a PAR bomb in an oil bath being heated, and I've referred to the ingenious approach taken by New Zealand drug cooks. In this case, the mixture, the reaction mixture, is simply put into a vessel, which the lid is screwed on, and the contents are heated strongly. And this actually is capable of producing the end product with very little manipulation and obviously very little skill. Pseudoephedrine is the main starting material for methamphetamine synthesis in New Zealand. It's been readily available over the counter, and the diversion of this material is an issue. But as well as that, there's significant importation of pseudoephedrine from overseas. The slide just shows some of the cold preparations that have historically been available. Having said that, in recent years there's been a trend away from products for the treatment of cold and flu symptoms containing pseudoephedrine to another alternative. The other issue is the importation of pseudoephedrine, and I just need to explain that pseudoephedrine and ephedrine are essentially interchangeable as precursors, but pseudoephedrine is more readily available. There's one favoured method in New Zealand which uses hydroiodic acid and red phosphorus, although it's possible to mix various combinations of chemicals to give the same reactive ingredients. There are other ways of manufacturing methamphetamine. Some of these also start with ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, but other options are phenyl-2-propanone or benzyl chloride. And there are other chemistries that can be used. One that's used and is relatively common these days in the United States and parts of Australia is the use of lithium metal in liquid ammonia. These are highly dangerous chemicals and require skilled handling. That particular route does require ephedrine or pseudoephedrine. Thionyl chloride, followed by catalytic hydrogenation, was the method that was used in the major Fijian lab that was seized a number of years ago. The catalytic hydrogenation requires a degree of chemistry skill, and it's accompanied by hazards that are a different order of magnitude, really, to the one that's being used in New Zealand. So we have an established route, and if the methamphetamine from ephedrine, if the ephedrine or pseudoephedrine was not available, it would certainly significantly disrupt the ability to synthesize methamphetamine. Seizure of pseudoephedrine precursor at the border is an issue, and I don't have more recent figures than these from customs, but there are certainly significant amounts being seized. I'm going to very quickly flick through a number of slides that have been provided by customs of examples of smuggling, some of which is quite ingenious and which involves very large amounts of pseudoephedrine. And that's an upside-down sofa that you can see there. That is a form of pseudoephedrine known as Contact NT, which is actually capsules, but typically those capsules are emptied, so you just have the pink granular contents of the capsule in plastic bags. I'd like to acknowledge the support of the drugs and clam lab teams at ESR in providing this information. And the final slide is just the our mission statement. Thanks. Back to you, Darcia.
Thanks very much. All right. I will now pass to our next speaker, Peter Black, University of Auckland.
Right. Hello. I've been asked to talk about nasal decongestants and alternatives to pseudoephedrine. So nasal decongestants are agents which are used to treat a blocked nose. And this usually occurs because the blood vessels, particularly veins in the nose, are dilated. They're filled with more blood. And as well as the engorgement of these veins, there's also leakage of fluid from them. And the decongestants work by constricting the blood vessels and reducing the blood supply to the nose. And this slide just shows a cross-section of the nose, and the area which is identified as nasal congestion is where the main engorgement of these vessels is occurring. That the blood vessels in the nose are supplied by nerves that release noradrenaline. So noradrenaline is a substance released from nerve endings that's very similar to adrenaline, which is secreted by the adrenal gland and circulates in the blood, but they have similar actions. And the noradrenaline released from these nerve endings constricts blood vessels, in this case, the blood vessels in the nose. And the reason for telling you this is that the decongestants have a similar mode of action. So pseudoephedrine, which is usually taken in tablet form, acts to release noradrenaline from the nerve endings. It doesn't act directly on the blood vessels itself. In contrast, there are nasal sprays available, and I've listed one here, xylometazoline. There's another one, oxymetazoline, which act directly on the blood vessels to constrict them in a similar way to noradrenaline. And both approaches are effective as nasal decongestants. The nasal sprays shouldn't be used long term. There is a concern that if you were to use them for several weeks, that things haven't got better may get worse again. Having said that, that's a relatively uncommon problem with xylometazoline or oxymetazoline. It was more a problem in the past with when there was a phenylephrine nasal spray, which is no longer available, where if you used it for more than a week, there could be a rebound worsening. Nonetheless, we usually advise people don't use it for more than the sprays for more than 10 days. The pseudoephedrine doesn't, when taken by mouth, doesn't have this problem with the rebound, but it does have other problems. The commonest side effect that people report with taking pseudoephedrine is insomnia, although it sometimes can put the blood pressure up a bit as well. The next statement just covers material I've already discussed on the mode of action of pseudoephedrine versus xylometazoline. So what causes not blocked noses and where you might want to use decongestants? Well, the commonest use probably are simple colds. Having said that, colds are usually self-limiting, and most people get by with taking no medication at all in that the nasal congestion usually resolves over a few days. However, if one does want to use a decongestant for the blockage of the nose with a cold, both pseudoephedrine and xylometazoline will work, or oxymetazoline, and these sprays are effective and can be used and are used. The other main cause for blocked nose is hay fever or allergic rhinitis. This is due to breathing in allergens such as grass pollen or dust, which set up inflammation in the nose and cause congestion. But that's not the only symptom. As well as a blocked nose, people have a running nose and itching nose, sneezing. And I think that's important because the decongestants aren't going to treat all of these other problems. So the most effective treatment is one which deals with the underlying problem, which is inflammation of the nose secondary to allergens. And the most effective treatment for that is a steroid nasal spray. And that's going to treat the underlying problem and is the most effective treatment we have. The only caveat here is steroid nasal sprays take a few days to work, and initially people may want to take other medications such as an antihistamine or a decongestant for a few days. However, a decongestant is a long-term treatment. Quite aside from this concern about rebound worsening with sprays, is not going to be as effective as a steroid nasal spray, which is the standard of care for this problem. One of the issues that's come up is the efficacy of phenylephrine. I mentioned before in the past as a nasal spray it was used, although it's no longer the case because of problems with rebound worsening with long-term use. It's now been put in the oral cold remedies as an alternative to pseudoephedrine, and there's been questions about the efficacy. And the literature doesn't actually support the sort of doses that are available in cold remedies, which are usually 5 to 10 milligrams. And there have been studies both in people with colds, which is administering the oral phenylephrine, and then measuring how blocked the nose is. There are various techniques for measuring how blocked congested the nose is. And it's not terribly effective, and the reason is it's not well absorbed, or more strictly speaking, it's metabolized in the gut and liver before it can get to the rest of the body. There have been other studies where patients with allergic rhinitis have had allergen instilled in their nose, which then produces blockage, and the phenylephrine has been given. And in contrast to other medications, such as antihistamines, has been of relatively little effect. Having said this, I guess we need to put in context, which is although the phenylephrine and the cold remedies may not be useful, there is a whole question about how useful cold and cough remedies are altogether. There's considerable literature showing that cold and cough remedies are not actually effective in treating cough, and that reflects other constituents of these remedies unrelated to congestion of the nose. So the summary is that if someone does have a cold and requires a decongestant, a spray such as xylometazoline is an entirely reasonable and effective alternative to pseudoephedrine and will be more effective than a cold remedy which contains oral phenylephrine. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.